From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, on this 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the story of Muhammad Ali's trip from Michigan to Ground Zero.
You'd hear people yelling, "Ali's here, the champ's here." Total strangers would run up and just grab onto him and hug him, and he would hug them.
The race is on to be the site of Amazon's new second headquarters, but what if the company already knows where it wants that second HQ?
This is going to become a distraction, a huge distraction for a great number of cities and states as they all bid to compete for what's already been decided.
And the Maroon family floats a plan for Michigan Central.
He laid out an idea, a vision of having trains at the train station again, making the train station a hub again.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In those terrible days following September 11th, 2001, New York was shattered with grief, sadness, and anger. As recovery workers picked through the still smoking ruins of the Twin Towers, a clearer picture emerged of what happened on those jets and the 19 attackers. And that triggered a rising tide of rage directed at Muslims. And that's why on the morning of September 20th, just 9 days after the Twin Towers fell, a small private jet took off from Benton Harbor, Michigan, bound for New York. Aboard, Muhammad Ali on a mission of comfort and peace. Also on board was my next guest, George Franklin, an executive with Kellogg at the time, here now with a remarkable story. George, how did this all begin, you taking Muhammad Ali to Ground Zero?
Well, let me just say by the beginning, most everyone of a certain age knows exactly where they were on 9/11. I have seared in my memory the date of September 20th, the day I took Muhammad Ali to Ground Zero. And what had happened was a couple of days after 9/11, Mayor Giuliani's office contacted our relatively new CEO, a fellow named Carlos Gutierrez, about could we help facilitate getting Muhammad Ali to Ground Zero. And Muhammad Ali had issued a statement speaking out against the violence as a Muslim. And the mayor and the governor and others thought it would be important as a lifting of spirits and also for healing to have him come to New York. So I was called over to Carlos's office, and Carlos says, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think we ought to do it." And he said, "Okay, I want you to go with him." So on September the 20th, 9 days after 9/11, I got up about 5:30 in the morning in Kalamazoo and did the 30-minute drive to Battle Creek, where I got on the Kellogg jet, and we did about a 10-minute flight to Benton Harbor, where we had arranged with the Whirlpool people to pick up Ali, his wife Lonnie, and two business associates to fly to New York. So we got on the plane, flew to White Plains, New York, and on the way, I was watching Ali, and a lot of people asked me, they said, you know, how was he and what was he like? And
that's what I'm wondering. You had such a close proximity to him through that flight. And I'm wondering about Ali and also about his interactions with Lonnie, his wife.
Oh, when we took off, the Parkinson's was quite obvious. He was shaking, and we had some muffins and coffee and things on the plane. And he put on a sort of a bib-like thing, so to eat a muffin with a lot of spilling. And we had real casual chit-chat. He didn't talk a lot, but we were maybe about 20 minutes out of White Plains, and it was interesting. He looked at me, he said, now tell me what happened again. And I said, "Well, champ," I called him champ the whole day. I said, "Well, champ, you know, these terrorists flew into the building and thousands of people have been killed, and your statement of speaking as a Muslim against violence is important, and we all think it's important for you to be here to buoy the spirits of the early responders, of cops, the firemen, and so on." He looked at me and he said, "They're not mad at me, are they?" And his wife, Lonnie, was obviously a very caring person for him. And the love was quite obvious. And she said, no, they're not mad at you. And, you know, this is a good thing we're doing. And so he was a little confused by where we were going and why we were doing this, is be honest.
So you land in White Plains, and then your first stop was to the closest fire station right across the street from where the Twin Towers were. I'm thinking that's probably Engine 10, Ladder 10.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the grief was overwhelming. I mean, we pulled up. We had a police escort take us in from White Plains. And as we pulled up, there were flowers everywhere in front and people in just grief that was unimaginable. Governor Pataki was there. Mayor Giuliani was there. And there were a group of loved ones of these firefighters who had just gathered and were in mourning. And I learned later watching him, the champ had sort of a little routine.
Well, he gets out of the car, and what do people do when they see him first?
They come up, and they grab him, and they hug him. And it intrigued me all day. Total strangers would run up and just grab onto him and, like I said, hug him. And he would hug them. And then they would start talking about where they were when he fought so-and-so and where they were when he did this and that. And, you know, talking about it later with a friend of mine, he said, well, you were with probably one of the three or more famous people in the world at that point.
No doubt.
And people's reaction to him was just, it was incredible. And he would do a little routine. He would do this. He'd let people go up and put their fist up on his chin like they were punching him. And then people would take their photos.
So you could say, I punched the champ.
Punched the champ, yeah.
He was a great sport.
He was a great sport. And he kidded around with some of the people about, you know, he was going to knock them cold and do things like this. But he lifted a lot of people's spirits. And from there, we went out to the pier.
Pier 92 was the command center,
yes. And it was just incomprehensible, the grief. There was a wall with maybe 1,000 pictures of loved ones who were missing. They'd be everything from high school graduation pictures to official photos to, you know, they were just plastered on this wall. And we came in with Ali, and they had a golf cart for him. And we got him in a golf cart, and people would just mob him. People would come up and grab hold of him, and just he inspired people. It was just ongoing. And it you could tell people their spirits were lifted is the only way I can keep saying it. And I can't ever adequately describe it because it's indescribable.
And what did he say particularly about Islam and peace?
Well, actually, the next step after the pier where he was literally mobbed by people and we spent, I don't know, another hour or so there, we went over to hold a press conference. And the way he addressed the religious issue, I thought was very poignant. And what he said was, and let me quote, "Rivers, ponds, lakes, and streams, they are all the same. They have different names, but they all contain water. As religions have different names, they all contain the truth." And the press room just went silent. No one knew what to say. No one knew a follow-up questions. It was so well done. He addressed the issue in a beautiful way.
He did.
After the press room, we then went to see the inconceivable, Ground Zero. And we drove through New York, and to think of a military checkpoint with armed military in the streets of New York, it was surreal. And ahead of us, about two or three blocks from this checkpoint, was, and I'm going to guess, 13 stories of smoking rubble. It was still smoking. You could not believe what you were seeing. And so we drove up there, and they had tents set up all around the site where the emergency workers were working, to be the cops or the firemen, EMTs and sort of thing. And so once again, being the sport that he is, we spent a couple hours just going tent to tent. And people would run up and take their picture and grab hold of him, and groups would form around him. And you'd hear people yelling, "Ali's here, the champ's here." And these firefighters and cops and different people would come and all gather around him.
Did it affect him?
Yeah. I mean, he clearly had a feel for the emotion of these people and the grief that was there. And he was here's this ultimate fighting machine that was such a teddy bear. I mean, he would just hug people. And he was very well aware of the emotion that he was creating. And he was also very embracing and comforting everywhere he went with everybody. And I kept thinking, here's this ultimate fighting machine that was just once again sort of this big teddy bear.
And you think that, as you say, his Parkinson's was advanced.
Yep.
He was not in great shape, but that was a grueling day.
It was a very grueling day. In fact, we then left Ground Zero after a couple hours there, drove back to White Plains where we got on the company jet, flew him back to Benton Harbor, dropped him, Lonnie and his two associates off. Then I took the little 10-ride back to Battle Creek. I drove back to Kalamazoo, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm sitting in my living room, and I said, where have I been and what have I seen? It was inconceivable. But I will say that I looked and I thought how proud I was of the company I worked for, the cops, the firemen, the emergency workers, who they were, what they were doing. I mean, this was gut check time for the United States, and they stood up and stood up strong. And I was just proud to be an American. And I'm sitting there at 1 o'clock in Kalamazoo, having seen this, and as I started our conversation, it's just seared in my memory of these people. It was quite a sight.
And it's a story that is not particularly well known.
No.
It was kept quiet because what it was more about, let's get Muhammad Ali to these hurting people rather than let's look for some spotlight for us.
Yeah. One of the reasons I say I was so proud of the company was before, during, and after, they never publicized it. They didn't promote it. They didn't beat their chest about it. They just stood up and did it because it was right. And a lot of people could have, for mercenary reasons, exploited it and taken advantage of it. And until I ended up telling this story, it's not very well known by many people. And it's just a wonderful tale of a community, a company, and just some really good people saying, we're going to do the right thing and let's go.
George, why do you think it is still worth people hearing this story now, absorbing what happened?
Well, I think it's a tale that really needs to be told now because it's a tale about this country coming together when tough times happen. And we've got a lot of division, a lot of turmoil, a lot of political controversy. But the reality is, as I mentioned before, this was gut check time for the United States. And people stood up together, Muslims, Christians, Jewish, you name it. And I mentioned to you earlier, I've never been to the memorial site. And people have asked me, do you want to go see it? And I said, not really, because I'm never going to see anything taller, more powerful, or more stronger about this country than what I saw that day, September 20th. There's no memorial that can match it.
George Franklin, it is a remarkable story, sharing the story of you accompanied Muhammad Ali to Ground Zero just 9 days after the towers fell. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside and sharing.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Violin teachers are celebrated for their students' fame and virtuosity, but Michigan Radio's Catherine Schaefer brings us the story of a teacher whose genius is showcased in a less grandiose but arguably more difficult accomplishment, getting a three-year-old to stand still.
This middle school auditorium is packed with kids and parents. The aisles are jammed with strollers. Kids with violins are lined up on both sides of the stage. They're so little, you can't believe some of those instruments aren't hitting the floor. But the musicians hold on tight. This is a rehearsal for the Ann Arbor Suzuki Institute's annual spring concert, and the kids are excited. In fact, the energy in the room seems just about to burst out into total chaos. And then this happens. The musicians can't tie their shoes yet, but right now their fingers, wrists, elbows, and feet are all working together. Wendy Ezrak's specialty is training these youngest violinists. She's well known across the country as a teacher of teachers. She knows how to hold the attention of tiny children and teach them a new language, music.
I can take a little beginner who's a very distractible child, and pretty soon they're holding their violin while I count to 100, standing absolutely still. I've had their neighbors go, "No way you're getting that kid to stand still." In 2 weeks, they're standing still.
To get that, there's one quality she had to have in abundance.
She was super patient. You know, we do what was called shadow playing, I think, where she would just play the song and I would just hear it and then try and do it back. And we'd do that for about a half hour. And that was the lesson sometimes, you know, and that stuff really did kind of fortify what I am as a musician these days.
That's Wesley Fritzmeyer. He's a jazz and bluegrass musician. And he's just one of hundreds of students that have learned with Ezrak. She started teaching in the 1970s. Back then, Suzuki was a countercultural movement.
It was radical in that you didn't start with reading. You started because we were working with a language base, and babies don't read.
That's the whole idea behind the Suzuki method. Let children learn music intuitively, the way they learn their first words. It's easy for the kids. It's not even remotely easy for the teachers.
Teaching young students is sometimes really mortifying for musicians and teachers.
That's Andrea Yoon. She's a Suzuki cello teacher, and she's worked with ESRAC for about 10 years. ESRAC is known around the country for training other teachers. She says Wendy ESRAC's special sauce is really about getting people past that discomfort.
It's the feeling of letting people be a part of a whole. So she gives that feeling really well. There's this whole of the Suzuki method, and you're a part of it now because you're taking this training, and welcome.
Back at the rehearsal, the big kids get their turn to play. Wendy ESRAC recently retired after 40 years of teaching. She leaves behind a community she built around Suzuki music and a new generation of teachers to follow in her footsteps. I'm Catherine Schaefer.
The Unabomber was one of America's most notorious outlaws in the 20th century, and he may have never been caught if it weren't for a little help from here in Michigan. Premiering this past August on the Discovery Channel, the new show Manhunt Unabomber recreates efforts by law enforcement to nab one of the country's most wanted men. From 1978 to 1995, someone mailed or hand-delivered a series of bombs. Ultimately, three people were killed and 23 others were hurt. 18 years of fear ended April 3, 1996. That's when FBI agents swarmed a remote cabin in Montana and arrested Theodore Kaczynski. Retired FBI agent Greg Staskel was based in Ann Arbor, and he helped the massive effort to find the Unabomber by snagging a crucial piece of information from the University of Michigan. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, Cindy.
This really was a national scare and an important example of homegrown terrorism, wasn't it?
It was, and it was, I want to say, unique. It was sort of the quintessential mad bomber kind of thing that, and it went on for that long period of time.
Bombs were being delivered all over. It wasn't just was confined to one area, you know, across the country.
There were, and one of the most frustrating aspects for this long investigation was that it was difficult to find a common theme. The very name Unabomber comes from an effort to do that. It's basically an acronym of University and Airlines Bomber.
May 25th, 1978, it started with a bomb that injured a police officer at Northwestern University, and then 16 bombings over those 17 years. But it took a while to kind of find any kind of theme?
That's correct. It basically, it was very difficult. And of course, we had had one of the bombs here, the 10th bomb.
That's right, 1985. So one of these bombs arrived at the home of a University of Michigan psychology professor. Tell us about him and what happened.
Well, James McConnell was a psychology professor at the University of Michigan, had some notoriety, had written several books, and had done experiments regarding, for lack of a better word, not being a psychologist, but it had to do with manipulation of mind. And he did a lot of studies with flatworms. Flatworms are rather low on the feeding chain, but he was drawing conclusions based on human psychology, based on his experiments with flatworms. And as we learned later, that was one of the things that set off Ted Kaczynski and caused him to mail a bomb to Professor McConnell.
And what happened with Professor McConnell?
Well, the bomb was delivered through the mail and was delivered to his home. And one of his graduate assistants took delivery of the package. The bomb was contained. Professor McConnell, on occasion, would read papers and theses and things like that and comment on them. Ostensibly, that's what this was. It was a 5-pound package, and secreted inside a ream of paper, a hole was cut out in the paper, and the bomb was actually in there. And it was basically a pipe bomb using ammonium nitrate and powdered aluminum, which is like flash powder.
And how badly were they hurt?
Well, in that particular case, not too badly. The bomb was very carefully constructed. However, the classic pipe bomb uses threaded caps on each end, which causes the bomb, if you actually see it in slow motion, the pipe actually blows up like a balloon before it explodes. In this case, because the caps were made of wood, the ends blew out, and basically it caused this flash and explosion. So the graduate assistant was burned, not even severely burned, and there was significant damage to the kitchen where he was opening the package. But other than that, not too bad.
So, you know, everybody had to have been going, what's going on? There had to have been a massive investigation.
There was. And over a long period of time, many agents were assigned. I actually had I was case agent of the Ann Arbor bombing. But for a long time, you know, we covered all the usual leads and, again, tried to come up with a common theme, tried to do as much as we could to trace the package and everything. Ultimately, a task force was set up in San Francisco, and the reason San Francisco was chosen is a number of the bombs were mailed from San Francisco, and one of the newspapers that the Unabomber chose to communicate through was the San Francisco Chronicle. So the Unabomber task force was set up there. They did some tremendous investigation, setting up databases. They had literally thousands of suspects, but they were not able to come up with Ted Kaczynski or, you know, even any good solid leads that led anywhere until.
Until he insisted that a manifesto that he wrote be published. And you say without that, Kaczynski may have never been caught?
I think that's true. You know, it's hard to speculate
sure.
what might have happened, but certainly he wouldn't have been caught as soon as he had been. And
what was in the manifesto? What was it that was helpful?
Well, it was a 35,000-word diatribe. And I guess it goes back to the adage, pride goeth before the fall. And he wanted to have his philosophy, the things that were causing him to do these bombings, he wanted that out there, his reasoning. And the manifesto, he wanted it printed in a major newspaper. There was a lot of controversy amongst the task force and the hierarchy at the FBI. And I should add that there were a couple other agencies involved in this investigation from the beginning, the Postal Service and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They all had agents assigned to the task force and were involved. But it was ultimately decided that if we put the manifesto out there and publicized it, that probably someone who knew Ted or was aware of his writings would come forward.
You could get an aha moment.
Exactly.
And his brother was coming forward.
Ultimately, it was his brother. First of all, we had to convince, well, we went to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we had to convince the editors that this manifesto should be published. And they were reluctant. 35,000 words is a very expensive proposition for a major newspaper.
Plus, if you publish that, then the next character is going to want his stuff published.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's the thing of trying to negotiate with terrorists and that type of thing. At any rate, they were able to convince the New York Times and the Washington Post. A tactical decision was made to have it only published in the Washington Post. The reason for that is the Washington Post, at least during the week, is only available in San Francisco in two places. And again, the prevailing theory was that he was in San Francisco and that because of his ego or hubris, he would want to have a printed copy of his manifesto and see it in print. So the New York Times agreed to help finance the printing of the manifesto. The Washington Post agreed to publish it on a weekday, and we set up a massive surveillance in San Francisco, which resulted in nothing because, as we would later learn, he wasn't there.
He wasn't there.
But at any rate, fortunately, we actually received thousands of leads, and it was published in September of 95. But ultimately, it came to the attention of David Kaczynski, Ted's brother, and his wife. And his wife, Linda, had, for a period of time, had some suspicions that he might be the Unabomber. David, probably because he was his brother, didn't share that opinion. But she told him to read the manifesto, and he did. And then he, too, came to the conclusion that it was a strong possibility.
A light went on.
Yeah.
And then how did you fit into this, being able to get information from the University of Michigan?
Well, the task force had received these documents from David Kaczynski. They had been redacted. A lot of the personal information had been taken out, but there were a few things left in there. Joel Moss, who was a supervisor at the Unabomb Task Force, who I knew, called me and said, hey, we've got these documents, and they look a lot like the manifesto. There's a lot of wording and things that are very similar. And we've been able to determine, based on information left in the documents, that the individual who wrote these, first name was Ted, and that could either be Theodore or Edward. He had done undergraduate studies at Harvard and done graduate studies and may have received a graduate degree from University of Michigan and then went on to Berkeley. And they had determined that he was either born or grew up in Chicago. I think that was basically it. We had an age time frame, which turned out to be a little off because we weren't aware that Ted Kaczynski had skipped a couple grades. So consequently, with that information, I got a hold of a good friend of mine who was the assistant director of the Department of Public Safety at the University of Michigan. I knew full well I wouldn't get cooperation with Michigan, at least not easily. And I was afraid that a lot of this stuff would get out. So I called Jim Smiley. And to his credit, he never at the time asked me. I told him it was a very important and sensitive case, but I didn't tell him what case. He didn't question my sanity. He just said, well, let me see what I can do. And he got back with me within hours. I got the call from Joel Moss on February 12th in the evening. And Jim got back to me the following morning. And he said, I've got about five possibles, but only one of them seems to fit everything. And he's not perfect, but it's Ted Kaczynski. I immediately called Joel Moss and said, hey, I've got a name, Ted Kaczynski, explained to him. And he said, that sounds really good, and said something to the effect, at this point in time, you and I are the only ones who know who the Unabomber is, and you can't tell anyone. That began the full court press that we did with the surveillance in Lincoln, Montana, and everything else.
Ultimately sweeping in and arresting him. And he had the makings of another bomb in the cabin, didn't he?
He did. And the thing you have to understand is we knew at that point that he had written the manifesto, but that didn't prove he was the bomber. When they went to Montana, they were in the process and continued for about a six-week period writing the affidavit for the search warrant for the cabin. This was a crapshoot because it was one throw of the dice. If there had not been evidence in that cabin, we would have had a very difficult time determining that he was the Unabomber.
Based on the manifesto and once he was arrested and things he said, what was the overall point? What was he trying to prove with these bombs?
He was, as I understand it, he subscribed to the philosophy of being a Luddite. And a Luddite is, you know, somebody that is opposed to technology. And that basically was his philosophy. And he felt that technology was not serving humankind. In effect, technology was controlling humankind. And there's, you know, quite frankly, there's a lot of things in his philosophy that make a lot of sense.
It's just the problem that he was backing them up by sending bombs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I should stress that when we did go into the cabin, we didn't have an arrest warrant when we did the search. We did the search, and in there was, even though he had promised that when he did the manifesto, he would not send any more bombs, or at least not target people. But in the cabin was an anti-personnel bomb, and when I say that, it had shrapnel in order to kill people. And that was actually ready to go. It was all packed up and ready to be mailed. There was also materials to make bombs. He left a journal that basically explained all of the bombings and how he had made them. Lists of addresses where the bombs had gone. We found the typewriter that he typed the manifesto on. So it was a treasure trove of information.
And he's in the Supermax prison, isn't he?
He is, you know, and it's interesting. He had written in his diary, and I got a copy of it from Joel Moss. He had written in his diary when he was at the University of Michigan, which he considered some of the worst days of his life for some reason. But at any rate, he had written that he had decided that it would be okay to kill people, but his biggest fear was that if he killed someone, not that he would be executed, but that he would have to spend the rest of his life in jail. That seemed to be his worst nightmare.
And think about it, that Colorado Supermax prison, I think they're locked up 23 hours a day, aren't they?
That's correct.
Well, it certainly shows there are many, many cogs in turning the wheels of an investigation. There's no one person that can be taking a bow. It certainly was a massive effort.
This was a huge team effort, and people have said to me after the fact, you know, you identified the Unabomber, and I said, not really. I was just a cog in a big machine that was moving inexorably towards identifying Ted, and everybody played a part, and I actually played less of a significant part than a number of other people, like the guy that wrote the search warrant, Terry Turchi and Jim Freeman. These guys talked the Bureau and the New York Times and Washington Post into printing that manifesto. All of these things contributed to it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people after the fact that have tried to take credit for a number of things, and it really was a great, tremendous team effort.
One of the most historic and notable cases, notorious cases, we should say, from the 20th century, the Unabomber. Retired FBI agent Greg Stayskull, thanks so much for the story.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision. Creation.
The next idea.
You need to tell a story.
NASA is working on a new project meant to advance our ability to deflect asteroids away from our planet. While the next idea is Jeff DeGraff likes the innovation angle, he's a little concerned that the technology might not just be about defending ourselves against rocks from outer space.
One afternoon while waiting for my flight to board, a headline caught my eye. Civilization-destroying comets are more common than we thought. I assumed it was one of those flashy clickbait attention grabbers, like the ones about how researchers have discovered how you can lose 10 pounds just by drinking dandelion tea. Much to my surprise, it wasn't one of those smarmy websites you've never heard of. It was Popular Mechanics. Yes, that do-it-yourself periodical for the pocket protector jet set that has all the panache of your dad's brown shoes. So why the hyperbole? Well, last February, a video of an asteroid that flew over the University of Wisconsin made its way around the internet. At first, I thought it was just a viral marketing gimmick for another end-of-days flick. Apparently not. Scientists have known that we've been in harm's way for some time. Computer simulation models now suggest that our chance of being collateral damage in some catastrophic collision with asteroids is 7 times greater than previously reported. Okay, so now what? Stop saving for retirement? Forget the whole climate change thing. No worries. NASA is on it. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART for short, is the space agency's way back to relevance with the general public. Okay, the moon landing thing was spectacular 50 years ago, but it will take more than the stuff we see now, like psychedelic photos of nebulas and deep space, to justify NASA's $20 billion budget. That requires something big, like, say, saving humanity. From an innovation standpoint, this meteor-deflecting technology is right out of science fiction. NASA plans to test it in 2022 on a pair of asteroids called Didymos A and Didymos B. A pool table-sized craft will careen into space, locate the asteroids using an onboard autonomous targeting system, and crash into the smaller one at a speed 9 times faster than a bullet. This interstellar demolition derby will be monitored via a complex array of computer networks and telescopes, with artificial intelligence doing the play-by-play. Observing the outcome of the kinetic impact will help NASA understand how this strategy could work on Earth-threatening asteroids in the future. Our friendly neighborhood geniuses at NASA assure us that there is no chance that this little experiment could accidentally create a hazard for those of us down here on the blue planet. Still, I'm a little troubled by some of the descriptions of DART as a weapon. You need only imagine what such a spacecraft could do given a military application. Satellites, space stations, and all types of lunar modules currently in development could be possible targets. Coincidentally, conservative columnist George Will recently published a provocative piece in the Washington Post suggesting that the U.S. Air Force needs to refocus its efforts beyond our exosphere. Of course, the mission of NASA is scientific and humanitarian, But I can't help but wonder if DART is being carefully watched as a possible way of advancing American superiority in space. This all leads to my underlying suspicion about the whole matter. Is DART just a proof-of-concept experiment, like any innovation prototype? Or is our space agency trying to tell us something? If so, I'd really like to know what it is, so I can stop worrying about counting calories and whether my next flight will actually depart on time.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Late last week, Amazon created a huge splash by announcing plans to build a second headquarters in North America. The online retail behemoth dropped a request for proposals, an RFP, online, and let the competition begin. Governor Snyder immediately declared Michigan would be perfectly positioned to welcome Amazon with open arms. Economic leaders in Southeast and West Michigan say they want to make a pitch for the Amazon project. And of course, there are the likes of New York, Chicago, Dallas, Boston, and other big cities. Chad Livengood of Cranes Detroit has been comparing what Amazon is looking for with what Michigan can offer, and he joins us now via Skype. Chad, this is pretty much a jump ball, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. It's going to set off an interstate bidding war. I mean, if you take away taxpayer incentives, that will obviously be part of this because they want basically, you know, a legislature that's malleable to them for this. There's a couple of big areas, glaring areas, where Michigan, Southeast Michigan, and Detroit in particular just don't meet what their RFP calls for. The big first one is mass transit. They want quick access to an international airport. We have a world-class airport at Detroit Metro. We do not have a very good connection between downtown Detroit and the airport of the region, or to Novi and the airport, or Auburn Hills to the airport, if you ever try to take that drive. So that's one big strike that we have, is we never built a commuter train system like Chicago, like Minneapolis and Dallas and Denver and so many other cities. And so that's one area we fall right below the minimum requirements that Amazon's talking about. The other big area is workforce and talent. We still lag behind some of those big peer regions in bachelor's degrees attainment. We do have world-class universities, but we have a problem of people getting their computer engineering degree at University of Michigan and then going to Chicago or Boston or Seattle to work for Amazon. And so we have a strategic issue there that we'd have to address, and Amazon wants to have quick and easy to access talent. Now, it could bring them back too. This certainly could be a major magnet overnight, and at the same time, it would create new competition with existing industry, namely the auto industry, for computer engineers who are becoming more and more hard to get for the big three and the foreign automakers that have big tech campuses in around Southeast Michigan. So you could see wages go up. You could see a big, big demand for those sectors. And then it brings quality of life issues like education, available housing. We're going to be building several thousand new units in and around downtown Detroit in the next couple of years. But just imagine putting 50,000 new people in greater downtown Detroit working every day. Not all of them are going to live downtown or be able to, or, you know, it could push other people out as it drives up prices and demands. We're talking about average annual salary and benefits of $100,000. Or more for these jobs at Amazon. So, you know, while it would be a big, huge boost, it would also just greatly change the landscape. And so you have to kind of adapt to that. And if you don't have a train system that can get people from the, you know, far-flung suburbs into the central city, then you have to start figuring out how would you possibly be able to handle this? Because, my Lord, 50,000 more cars on the lodge and 75 every day. Holy traffic jam, Batman.
Indeed. And speaking of trains, let's pivot right over to your new story for Cranes Detroit and what the Maroon family is thinking of for Michigan Central Station. As everyone who was around in 1988 remembers, that's when the train stopped running at Michigan Central. The Maroons bought the building in 95, have taken a lot of heat for letting it basically sit and rot for the better part of two decades. But you've talked to Matthew Maroon. What's he got in mind?
Well, on Tuesday, I sat down with Matthew Maroon. He laid out an idea, a vision of having trains at the train station again. making the train station a hub again for Amtrak and also connections to the high-speed rail in Ontario that takes people to Toronto and probably on to Montreal, and also having a direct shot rail, commuter rail to Detroit Metro to solve one of the issues that Amazon is going to want if they were to come to Detroit. And literally the next day, Amazon drops this big proposal. And so they are sort of related here in that if you're going to try to bridge the gap between Metro Detroit and downtown's core, rail and or bus rapid transit seem like the two best technologies right now, because it's changing. You know, autonomous cars are going to change everything probably, but technologies right now that could make and bridge that gap. It's an audacious, ambitious idea from Matthew Maroon, the son of Matty Maroon, owner of the Ambassador Bridge and a big trucking company empire. But he's kind of floating this out here to try to get some people thinking about, could this be on the map? I mean, and it would require a second queue line, basically, train running up and down Michigan Avenue to connect the central corridor, the central business district. Campus Martius is where Quicken Loans and other Dan Gilbert companies are, is 2 miles from the depot. But up until the 1950s, we still had a streetcar. The first half of the 20th century, the streetcar ran up and down that section. You can see the rails still in the road in Michigan Avenue and along the brick area. It's, you know, big thinking, and some might think it's pretty pie in the sky. And for the Maroons, who are a pretty recluse organization, to kind of come out publicly with this idea, different day at the Maroon headquarters.
Now, your piece in Crane says this price tag could be north of $100 million. Do you think the Maroons are serious enough about this to put their money into it, or are they looking for public money?
You know, that's the price tag to fix the building. I mean, that's the minimal price tag, probably. I mean, a lot of people think it's $300 million for a complete transformation. What they're throwing this train station idea into is how to utilize the existing infrastructure there better, in particular the concourse, which sits 3 stories high, 54-foot ceilings, and it's hard to reproduce and make something different out of that first floor concourse. The tower on that thing is 13 stories from there. Given the demand that's increasing for office space and residential, especially high-end residential, you know, you could plausibly on paper get the tower filled, they say. But the big elephant in the room, so to speak, is that concourse. And that's why Maroon says, why don't we make a transit hub again of some sort and get foot traffic in there? He doesn't want it to be a castle. He wants some public use to it. So yeah, when you start injecting the word public use, it's going to probably require public dollars. It won't be all privately financed. At the same time, Matthew Maroon also says if they could get a Fortune 500 company just to move in and take up the whole place, he probably wouldn't turn that deal down.
Interesting. Something to keep our eye on as this as he runs this idea up the flag to see who salutes. Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
So all these cities and states will be tripping over one another trying to land this prize. But Richard Shearer of the Brookings Institution argues there's a real good chance Amazon already knows where it wants to build its second headquarters, and this is a faux competition. Richard Shearer is a senior research associate and senior project manager with the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. Richard, your piece on the Brookings blog is titled Red Herring. Why do you see this RFP as a red herring?
I see it as a red herring in two ways. First, I see it as a kind of distraction from Amazon. They've set up this expectation of a competition when, in fact, it's very likely that Amazon already knows exactly where it wants to be. This is a very thoughtful, very competitive company that thinks years ahead. And so to think that they don't already have a very good idea of where they'd like to end up is kind of a farce. So my feeling is that they've set up this competition as a way to invite very generous bids where they can get some economic development tax incentives out of states and localities as a way of offsetting the costs of an expansion project. But in reality, there's really no need for the competition because they already know where they'd like to be.
So you're saying states and cities are just going to be pouring all these valuable resources, time and effort, and offering up breathtaking handouts, but it's a done deal in Amazon's head?
That's what I think, yes. And that's the second part of the red herring, is that this is going to become a distraction, a huge distraction for a great number of cities and states as they all bid to compete for what's already been decided.
So we have heard this tune before, haven't we?
Yeah, we hear it, all the time. Foxconn in Wisconsin a few months ago is another good example. Tesla did this last year or a couple years ago in Nevada. there's always a huge, huge prize on the horizon for economic development projects. And these corporations, large and small, do tend to play states and cities off of each other in this kind of game.
And do these big developments solve the problems that states and local governments hope they will?
Yes and no. In some states, you can land a big project that is transformative. And, you could argue that Amazon's second headquarters in Detroit or in Grand Rapids would be a huge, huge win that would really transform those places and attract a ton of talent. Or that Tesla's investment in Nevada is fundamentally changing that state. But what tends to happen is instead of aiding or helping the residents of those places, people who already live in your state or in your city, these projects instead tend to invite a whole lot of people with a lot of talent from out of state who kind of float around and take good jobs and spend money in the local economy. But that doesn't necessarily directly affect or help anybody in your place. And that's a big problem because we know that states and cities today face a lot of challenges, social and economic challenges, that acutely affect their residents. And these big projects may or may not someday indirectly affect those folks. But in the meantime, they're going to be a huge boon to the corporations who get the money and to the people who move in to take those jobs.
Richard, if I'm an economic development director for a city, why wouldn't I want to cast my hook into the lake and catch this big fish? What do you think would be a smarter, better approach to winning big business development?
A smarter, better approach would be to go back and take a look at Amazon's RFP, their request for proposals, look at what they've listed as the assets that they're looking for in a city, and say, all right, how do I, as a leader, convince my constituents and my stakeholders that these are the investments that we need to be investing in on an ongoing basis, that these are the things that are going to make us the place of the future, that are going to set us up for not just resilience, but also for really spectacular growth and prosperity in the 21st century. And then that's how you become stickier not just for the next Amazon deal that may be on the horizon, but also just for the businesses and residents that already live in your place who need more opportunity, who need that growth. So, I'd be going back and looking at the RFP and saying, okay, how do we invest in these assets so that we become more competitive, rather than having to hand out a ton of money every time Amazon comes knocking?
Richard Shearer with the Brookings Institution, where he's with the Metropolitan Policy Program. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us. It was an interesting piece, Amazon's Red Herring. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Many people believe that Howell is a hotbed of KKK activity, but what's the reason?
The reason why Howell has that reputation is actually very easily explained, and it's all because of one man who's been dead for 25 years now.
How the KKK's Grand Dragon tainted the history of Howell, next time on Stateside. Today's program was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Sarah Leeson, Jacob Meschke, and Daniel Hensel. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.